Hello and welcome to Verbatim. I'm Michelle Rayner.
You know, people say, oh, do you think you know better than Comrade Stalin? And it seemed ridiculous. That is why now I go my own way about anything, because I did know better than Comrade Stalin. Or rather, I had a vague suspicion that Comrade Stalin was not what we thought he was.
Playwright Oriel Gray, who died in July at the age of 83. One of the country's first women writers for the stage, Oriel Gray's best-known work was her play The Torrents, which won joint prize alongside Ray Lawler's Summer of the 17th Doll in the 1955 National Play Competition. Gray's play used humour and pathos to explore the position of women in Australian society, and it came to the public in a deeply conservative era in this country. All of her work reflected her interest in politics and ideas, and in her many plays she tackled racial discrimination, gender, and even environmental degradation. But in post-war, Cold War Australia, Oriel Gray's politically charged writing did not make her popular. And though she kept writing all through her life, including scripts for the pioneer television drama Bellbird, Oriel Gray missed out on the public recognition that she should have received. So it was just as well that one of her strongest characteristics was her resilience and an ability to view the world, and perhaps her own life, with a wry sense of humour. Oriel Gray's sense of irony may well have been sharpened as a result of an early immersion in radical politics. In the late 1930s, amid the rise of fascism around the world, 18-year-old Gray signed up as a member of the Communist Party and also joined the left-wing New Theatre. It was here that she began acting and also writing for the stage, beginning first with revues and later graduating on to writing full dramas. But Oriel Gray left the Communist Party and the New Theatre in 1949, cynical of the growing polemical nature of socialism, both in Australia and on the international front. She's been called one of Australia's best-known forgotten playwrights, as well as belatedly being recognised as one of our pioneer women writers. So when I recorded this interview with her in 1996, I asked Oriel Gray where her passion for writing had come from.
I had a marvellous English teacher at school, and she did two things. One, Daddy used to read, and then I used to read Lamb's Tales from Shakespeare, so, you know, this idea that Shakespeare is something out of the ken never happened to me. And I remember Miss Brown, she was a very large lady, but she had a beautiful voice and she could hold that class of little barbarians silent while reading the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. And when we were doing Shakespeare plays, we did two. We did The Midsummer's Night's Dream 1 year and Henry V second. She said Shakespeare wrote his plays to be acted, and she divided us all up into groups, and we couldn't wait for Friday afternoon to act it out. And I was all, you know, I was good at English and history, not much good at anything else. And she read one of my essays one day, and she said, you know, I'd said I wanted to be a journalist, which was practically impossible for a woman in those days. Then it was restricted to the social pages. And she said, you know, I think you could be a playwright. And I was bitten. And it was what I wanted to do. I don't think I ever thought. And I read plays prodigiously before I began to write, you know. I read my way, through every play in the old public library in Sydney. My sister, who was 9 years older than I was, and I loved her, and we did everything together, she joined a drama group, and then from belonging to a little theatre, we went to see Bury the Dead, done by Near Theatre, and we both, that was it. And then about a year later, we both joined the Communist Party.
Did you have much of a sense of political consciousness? Or?
Yeah. My father was what would be called left-wing Labour those days. And we often rebelled against sort of Dad's ideas, but we were brought up with regarding politics as
So when you joined the theatre, I mean, you were young. You were so young at this stage. You were only just out of school.
I was not quite 18 when I joined the party, and I joined the theatre the year before.
So I kiss and run, but the moment we're apart, oh, you fool, that was love, says my heart.
I joined the theatre also because I fell in love with a young man I saw in one of the plays that we went to see. That's another story of my life. I could never be casual. I had to go the whole hog. That's why I now can find myself to loving cats.
You had to fall for an actor too, of all people.
I started being a chorus girl in the reviews we used to do because I looked all right, had good legs, and both my sister and I used to prance around, not just on the stage, but we'd be sent out to prance around on trucks, you know, trying to get some hopeless candidate into a seat that had been, well, UAP as it was then, generations. You know, be out in Vaucluse singing revolutionary songs out of the reviews. And inevitably rain, there we are in our little red satin costumes dancing around. The party looked on us as bohemians, but we were a party front, no doubt about it.
Did the party, though, was the party suspicious of those, that the sort of lighter-hearted, satirical approach to politics?
Yes. I was once questioned by Wally Clayton, who was head of the Control Commission. There was a job going that someone wanted me to try for, and Wally looked over his glasses and said to me, there's been also said that wrote some very, what I suppose you would call blue jokes in the review. It was before Wally's time. He should have seen our first political review, I'd Rather Be Left, which was written by John Reed. And I can't think of the second bloke's name. Third one was James McCauley. Jimmy did the lyrics, or a lot of them. And they were sizzling. Someone got the idea, and it wasn't me, that the theatre should have a little radio session, and the current book distributors, which was another party front, bought some time on 2KY, which was the Labour station. But at this time, we grew up with radio, and this was the great blossoming of radio in America. So I plunged into that. Then I wrote Lawson in 43, and that was, while it was, I was adapting, it was still, there was a lot of creative writing in it.
What interested you in the character of Lawson?
Well, my father, Dada, I got the Bush influence was very strong. And long after my sister and I could read, My father would read to us. It must have been the actors' trainers back there too. So that things like The Man from Snowy River and Lawson's poems, and of course, Labour. Dada was left a widow when I was 6 and my sister was 15. Mm-hmm. The unions would have gatherings. He was very involved in the Clerks Union and in the Public Service Union. The union would have gatherings and someone would always recite Lawson, "When your pants begin to go, I'm too old to rat." So Lawson, I was writing, we used to have a workshop. My then husband, John Gray, who was an actor, he put on Lawson. So something happened, they couldn't get the current production on, so they put Lawson on for one night to fill in. And they had to put us on for 3 or 4 because they absolutely packed it out. When I first joined, it was at 36 Pitt Street, up above a wine bar. And then they moved to Castlereagh Street. There was a coffee shop underneath, and we used to go up these cement stairs. And they had quite a reasonable theatre there in one space, and then at the back there was what they called the office. Because I worked for the theatre, you know. I still say I was the first resident playwright. They'd always go to make me an office, but they never got to it. I just had a round table with a bit of the office I was going to get put up, and now by the time I left, they still hadn't made. But I did have the pleasure of sitting there once, typing away. I'd written a play. During the war, we began to get some professional people to do a bit for the theatre. And I'm typing away, and they were rehearsing a radio play that they were going to do a couple of nights. And looking up and seeing Peter Finch running down towards me and coming and gripping the table and saying, "That's one of the best radio plays I've ever done."
Were there other kind of overseas productions that other...
Well, most of our stuff did come from overseas, of course, when I was in the theatre. And long. The Russians, like their money's worth. We did one play called Aristocrats, which was about the building of the White Sea Canal. Now there's something, kid. And it went. It really was the longest play. I wasn't in it. I was ushering. I hadn't long joined the theatre. But this play went on so long, and it was full of moralising because all these bad characters were sent to build the White Sea Canal and they all got reformed. Well, they didn't get reformed. But I can remember at the it had 4 acts. At the end of the 3rd act, which came about 11:15, the audience staggered out and went home, most of them. And then we, of course, we began to do some of the good American plays. Then that began to be the season of the terrific American plays. And also the war, everyone loved everybody. So then, you know, things were loosening up. They did a couple of translations. They did some Brecht.
You must have been getting good houses at the New Theatre in those wartime days.
Oh, we did. We got very good houses. And, of course, Lloyd Lamble produced Mice and Men. Trying to get Australian writing didn't get underway, I would say. Oh, I suppose about 1943, because after the review, then we decided we're going to do another review, and we're all going to write sketches. And I was put in charge of it and ended up, I wrote the review, you know.
And what was your review about, Ariel?
The last one we did, Let's Be Offensive, everyone was pressing for the second front to be opened.
Yeah.
Let's Be Offensive, the last scene was set in hell. And Gibson, an artist who used to draw for Man, and he always did a hell, a double page on hell, and he was going to do it. And then something happened. He was really sick, couldn't do it. He said, what about Rowie Norton? Because Rowie was the King's Cross witch. And I remember Rowie. Beresford Conroy was the gentleman of her choice at the time. And they were living in what could have been charming. It was an old stables in the back of some old... the property somewhere.
Right, up the cross.
In the cross. Yeah. And Beresford offered us a drink or coffee, and there was a very nice, clean white rat, in fact, cleanest thing in the place. It's skipping between the coffee cups, so I settled for the drink, which was pretty ferocious, but still, I hadn't said that he might have had his feet there, but that was alcohol. So. Down descended Rowie. Anyway, yes, you do it. And no sign of Rowie, and it's about two nights before opening night, so apparently she sloped in about 7 o'clock one night, took, I think we were opening on a Sunday, this was a Friday night, took a look and said, whitewash those flats, I'll be back later, and went to the Greek Club where she used to consort with Dulcie Deemer and company. Anyway, back came Rowie. She had two bottles of sweet sherry and a tube of Benzedrine. And next morning there was this huge set of backdrops, all
so
painted.
Benzedrine and sherry.
Yeah. It was hell, and it was all these fantastic peaks and devils dancing along. And Ray Rowie used to talk about devils, you know. He thought, what's that behind my dress? They all used to congregate at Packy's too. That was this weird little place that used to stay open to all hours. It was in Elizabeth Street. We weren't supposed to go to Packy's either. Oh, the party kept a strict hand on our morals as far as they were able, because who knows, the revolution was right around the corner. There's still a certain amount of loving and all that went on. There was no feeling of we're different, because I was frowned on. You see, you were supposed to be one with the proletariat.
That's right.
Whether they wanted you or not. And, of course, the unions had such a strong... they were our basic audience. And they, unions, were very conventional. There were plenty of times, you know, we'd go out to do the meetings and we might be doing one in the afternoon, these goddamn factory gate meetings, and it inevitably rained and but then there'd be another meeting to go to do the sketch that night, and I'd come home and have a cup of tea, and there would be the gentleman laying himself out to be pleasant to these pretty girls, and wife would be toting in their homemade cake, and we'd go off and leave all the dirty cups. And I don't think we thought anything of it at the time. We were artists.
Yes.
Some people have said that what stopped me being a really good writer was my devotion to the theatre and the party. I was too narrow.
In one of the roundhouse
Claudius meetings in Sydney Domain for years, a crowd of around 40,000 people gather at an ALP rally on the coal strike. Communists are present in force, and while most onlookers are attentive, there are plenty of interjections.
By 1949, Oriel Grey had started to question her faith in communism. In the post-war years, with the threat of fascism no longer a uniting force, the broad church that comprised the Australian left found itself in something of a conundrum. Communism began to emerge as the bogeyman of the free world, and the old alliances between those on the left began to rupture. The Communist Party line hardened as the Cold War began in earnest, and Oriel Grey started to feel disillusioned with the intractable nature of the party's doctrine. For her, the crunch came with the deeply divisive coal strike of 1949, when the Communist Party forced the Chifley Labor government to bring in the army against striking miners, an act that Grey and others saw as triggering the fall of the government.
You see, I was in the party till after the war. I left the party in 50. My first serious doubt came with the Russo-German pact. I thought, what are we doing? So it was all these little bits. But the biggest thing was the coal strike, and I knew they should not have done that to Chifley. Yeah, I'm always inclined to be dramatic, and that's to me it was a terrible betrayal of Chif. I suppose Chif was the last Labor Prime Minister I admired. So I left the party in 50. But my sister was a very fervent party member. Grey wasn't a very fervent party member, but he wasn't prepared to have a fight about it. Do you think you know better than Comrade Stalin? And it seemed ridiculous. You see, it was so black and white, red, rouge et noir, That is why now I go my own way about anything, because I did know better than Comrade Stalin. Or rather, I had a vague suspicion that Comrade Stalin was not what we thought he was.
Playwright Oriel Grey, who died in July at the age of 83. Technical production today has been by Judy Rapley and Jenny Parsonage. I'm Michelle Rayner.